All right, let's continue our newspaper coverage on the Talking Information Center for this Thursday. It is the 11th of June, 2026. Time now to start the Boston Globe, and we say hello with the Boston Globe to Mary.
Hello, John, and welcome all listeners. The front page of our Globe today says, Mass public defense system broken, Inspector General says. Call it expensive and inefficient, by Leah Skeen of the Globe staff. The state inspector general is coming down hard on the public defense system in Massachusetts, which provides legal representation to poor people, calling it highly expensive, inefficient, and lacking proper oversight. The office of the inspector general has found several problems with the current structure, which came under intense scrutiny last year during a months-long work stoppage by lawyers demanding higher pay. The collective protest threw the state's busiest courts into crisis as more than 1,000 cases were dismissed and some defendants were released because they did not have access to counsel. A scathing report, which was released Wednesday, addressed the state's public defense system as a whole, which included both the government-employed public defenders and private attorneys paid by the state or bar advocates. While the work stoppage brought certain issues to the forefront, there are significant underlying flaws that require more attention, report found. The Inspector General Jeffrey S. Shapiro, in a statement, called the system broken and heaped blame on the state's public defender agency, the Committee for Public Counsel Services. Excuse me. He listed three main problems: the process for determining who qualifies for indigent defense, the caseload among public defenders, and the fee structure for bar advocates. Those must be addressed so that the Commonwealth can sustainably return our first set of pages. The state's chief public defender clapped back, refuting the notion of a broken system, calling it inaccurate and an insult to thousands of people who make that system work every day. The system is operating under sustained and well-documented pressure that has built over time as caseloads have increased, cases have become more complex, and resources have not always kept pace with the demand. CPCS Chief General Counsel Anthony Benedetti said in a statement Wednesday, but despite those pressures, this system that continues to change the law and change lives every day. The structure is largely unique to Massachusetts and a handful of other states. Roughly 80% of the indigent defendants in Massachusetts are represented by bar advocates. The other qualifying cases are staffed by CPSC staff attorneys. Those staff attorneys are constantly failing to meet legislative requirements to take 20% of the cases, the report says. They carry low caseloads compared to the neighboring states, and Massachusetts District Attorney Shapiro wrote in a letter to the state lawmakers and others. The agency also has too many supervisors and doesn't assign enough cases to staff attorneys. At the same time, Massachusetts spends more money per case than almost all other states, according to the report. Meanwhile, people who can afford to pay their own attorney fees are probably slipping through the cracks. Because the state's screening process is outdated and falling short, it is likely that significant numbers of defendants have received state-funded attorneys without a verified need. The process should be strengthened and modernized, including through a routine tools used by any merchant seeking to conduct a credit check. In many other states, the majority of the indigent defendants are represented by public defenders, and the court appoints private attorneys only if there is a conflict of interest. But in Massachusetts, bar advocates play a larger role. The crisis caused by their work stoppage could potentially have mitigated if the state's public defenders had taken on their 20% allotment. Perhaps our most troubling finding, the bar advocates were demanding a higher hourly rate, which they ultimately received from the legislature months later. But before they reached that agreement, cases were thrown out and defendants were released to protect their due process of rights, especially in Suffolk and Middlesex counties. Under Massachusetts law, defendants cannot be jailed for longer than 7 days without legal representation. Anyone must be appointed by a lawyer within 45 days. Otherwise, criminal charges against them may be dismissed. The report also slams the Committee for Public Counsel Services for failing to properly step up during the work stoppages to the detriment of the public and unrepresented defendants. In his statement, Anthony Benedetti said that the report exposes a fundamental disagreement over measuring success based on quality versus quantity. Plus, he said, a recent analysis found that Massachusetts public defenders are carrying significant and demanding workloads while continuing to meet their constitutional obligations. We are particularly concerned that the report relies heavily on caseload comparisons and assignments metrics without a sufficient attention to what criminal defense requires in practice. Public defense is not a mechanical system. Anthony Benedetti said that the agency will prepare and release comprehensive response to the Inspector General's report in the coming weeks. The two agencies are engaged in an ongoing litigation over whether the Inspector General can access certain information from criminal case dockets, which his office sought during this investigation. For their part, bar advocates felt somewhat validated because the report points to a bifurcated system that treats them differently from the CPCS staff attorneys. The report confirms how we're viewed as second-class citizens, said Sean Delaney, president of the Massachusetts Association of Private Appointed Counsels. The organization is continuing to push for a better hourly pay, saying compensation still lags behind other states despite astronomical cost of living in Massachusetts. Excuse me. The report also called for changes to the fee structure for bar advocates, something Sean Delaney took issue with. The current structure caps the total number of hours they can work per year without setting limits on individual cases. Also on our front page, we have not just stoves, gas leaks in home may be widespread. The study points to elevated levels of methane by Kate Selig of the Globe staff. You've heard that gas stoves pose a health risk, but the new research indicates that the threat may extend to your whole gas system. A Boston University study found that low levels of natural gas may be seeping into many homes in New England with gas heat. The gas contains pollutants, including benzene, known as a carcinogen, raising concerns that the residents are breathing in small quantities of toxins around the clock. There's no lower limit to what is considered to be safe for some of those compounds, said Nathan Phillip, a Boston University psychological ecologist and the study's lead author. Experts caution that more research is needed to establish whether these leaks jeopardize human health. Homeowners can look for leaks and plug them up, though some are difficult to address. Nathan Phillips said that the paper published in May provides one more reason for the state to consider transitioning off natural gas altogether. The study was funded by Zero Carbon Massachusetts, MA, I guess, a climate advocacy group based in Brookline, and published in the PLOS-1, a peer-reviewed journal of the Public Library of Science, a nonprofit that publishes free scientific research, including on climate and sustainability. The American Gas Association, a trade group, disputes the findings, but other scientists interviewed thought the study appeared sound. The study arrived amid a debate over the future of natural gas in Massachusetts, where policymakers are weighing the state's climate goals against concerns about rising energy costs. Though regulators previously laid out a framework transitioning away from natural gas, Governor Maura Healey excuse me, has signaled an openness to bringing more of it into the state. Natural gas remains the dominant heating source for Massachusetts homes. Researchers measured the concentration of methane, the primary component of natural gas, in the air of nearly 200 homes across Massachusetts and Rhode Island. Methane, which is considered safe to breathe at low concentrations, can be tested more cheaply and easily than the pollutants in the gas. They found that more than 90% of the residences used gas and had elevated levels of methane, even in newer builds, indicating the presence of leaks. The concentrations were so small that it can be difficult for homeowners to smell the gas. A 2022 paper led by the researchers at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and co-authored by Nathan Phillips found that unburned gas delivered to homes throughout the Greater Boston area contained a slew of hazardous air pollutants, including benzene, which the World Health Organization considers to be a carcinogen for which no safe levels of exposure can be recommended. Excuse me. Lindsay Burkhart, Chief of Science Officer at Harvard Center on the Developing Child, who was not involved in either study, said further investigation of leaks is needed to understand the health impacts. We spend more than 90% of our time indoors, so the quality of air in that space is as important. Sorry for the coughing. This is an important influence on our health, especially during pregnancy and infancy. Rob Jackson, environmental scientist at Stanford, who also unaffiliated with the study, said that while the leaks are cause for concern, the health risks posed by cooking with gas are likely even greater. When natural gas is burned, it releases pollutants such as formaldehyde, known as a carcinogen, and nitrogen dioxide, a gas that can worsen respiratory issues. These appliances have been linked to premature death and pediatric asthma. Gas-powered furnaces and water heaters, which also combust fuel, are required to be vented outdoors. For most of us, it's the flame that you need to worry about even more than the gas leaks for the day-to-day, month-after-month exposure. The American Gas Association, a trade group, disputed the findings. Richard Meyer, Vice President of Energy Markets Analysis and Standards, said the study was methodologically limited, including by not using a random sampling of households, and overstates what the data can support. Base staters deserve well-founded research that will allow them to make fact-based decisions rather than politically driven headlines that are not backed up by sound science. Nathan Phillips says that the researchers made sure that they had homes that represented a range of housing stock, including different types and ages. The Gas Association also identified an error in the table in the study. Meyer said that the issue calls into question analytical rigor of the project. Nathan Phillips acknowledges the error and have said that the research teams requested a correction. Gas Association and the authors agreed that the conclusions of the study were not affected. Still, climate and health advocates said that the study adds to the growing body of concern associated with using natural gas. In addition to health risks, the fuel is notorious for larger leaks across its supply chain that sends methane and superheated greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. They also argue that the state's reliance on gas has driven up energy costs. The advocates have notched big wins in recent years. A climate bill signed by Governor Charlie Baker in 2022 launched a pilot program in 10 cities and towns banning the use of fossil fuels in new buildings. The next year, state officials issued an order laying out new regulatory strategies to move the state beyond gas, including discouraging further expansion of the natural gas system and supporting residents switching to electric alternatives. Governor Healey, however, has embraced an all-of-the-above approach to energy, including signaling an openness to more natural gas. She backed a plan from Eversource increasing the gas supply in Massachusetts, stating that it would lower the gas bills. Ann Boland of Mothers Out Front, a Boston-based climate justice organization, said she wants to see the state ditch natural gas. She said residents can transition their homes to electrical appliances to eliminate the home leaks. This is something that people can, depending on their income level, do something about. Bob Ackley, a paper co-author and owner of Gas Safety, Inc., a methane consulting firm that carried out the testing for the study, said that if you suspect a gas leak, you should call 911 and your gas company to rule out a big leak that could cause an explosion. Bob Ackley said that testing for smaller leaks is not easily available to homeowners, in part because there is no demand for it. If you smell gas at a particular location, he said, you can apply for a soapy solution to watch for bubbles to see if the gas is escaping. As a last resort, he said, his company would also be open to testing homes for a fee. Nathan Phillips had to contend with a leak himself. Not long ago, Bob Ackley walked into his house and immediately said, I smell gas. I don't have a poor sense of smells, but I was completely oblivious to it, said Nathan Phillips. With further investigation, Phillips determined that the leaks were in his basement at a faulty pipe connection. He sealed it with putty, and the problem was solved, for now. But he is in the process of transitioning his home off gas appliances entirely. Something to think about. On the inside of our paper in the World column, a police step up security in Northern Ireland after violence. Anti-immigrant protests erupt across Belfast. Megan Spisa, New York Times, wrote this article. Police in Northern Ireland were increasing their presence Wednesday, and political leaders were urging restraint after a night of violence roiled the country in the wake of a brutal stabbing attack in Belfast. Firefighters and emergency responders escorted immigrant families from homes that had been set alight in Belfast on Tuesday night as car fires blazed in the street. A city bus was set on fire by a group that appeared to be mostly young men. Many of them masked, and on the New Townards Road in East Belfast, garbage cans engulfed in flames were used to create roadblocks elsewhere in the city. Two police officers were injured in the unrest described by the police as sporadic pockets of disorder across Northern Ireland. The violence came as authorities charged Hadi Eloud, a 30-year-old Sudanese man, with attempted murder in the stabbing attack Monday night, prompting calls from anti-immigrant activists for protests amid heightened tensions in the United Kingdom over immigration. Alloy did, a refugee and legal resident, appeared in Belfast court Wednesday morning. Prosecutors identified the attack victim as Stephen Ogilvy. He is in the hospital with serious injuries to his face, neck, and back, and prosecutors said he had lost an eye. Stephen Ogilvy's family said in a statement released Wednesday said that unrest is not welcome and asked for calm. The Police Service of Northern Ireland said in a statement that the large policing presence would be maintained across the country in the coming days to reassure communities and ensure public order. Some of the most harrowing scenes played out in Belfast, where families had to flee burning homes. Paul Doherty, a community worker and local councillor from West Belfast, described what he'd seen Tuesday night as absolutely appalling. The mobs of people basically chasing people from their homes. People were being terrorized simply because of the color of their skin or where they came from. He added that he met with and provided help to two women, one Sudanese and one other from Somalia, and four children who were forced from their homes after an arson attack. Government leaders issued sweeping condemnations of the unrest. Michelle O'Neill, the first First Minister of Northern Ireland, appealed for calm, saying that there could be no excuse and no justification for these attacks. Sorry, I have some water here. A group of masked men burning families out of their homes is nothing less than disgusting cowardice. This has nothing to do with the community. This is outright thuggery. Graphic video of the stabbing showed the suspect swiping at a man whose face and neck are covered in blood and had spread quickly online Tuesday, spawning a number of anti-immigrant posts and calling for protests. Among those stoking outrage over the stabbing was Tommy Robinson, a far-right English agitator with a number of criminal convictions. Robinson said, whose real name is Stephen Yaxley Lennon, urged people to take to the streets after what he called an invader attack on our people in posts in social media. Here we go. Billionaire Elon Musk had shared lists of locations around Northern Ireland for people to gather and report messages of far-right figures in Britain. John Butcher, chief constable for the police services of Northern Ireland, urged young people to think twice about the calls for violent protests, saying in Wednesday on a news briefing that it is very easy these days to look online and be persuaded by people who know nothing about Northern Ireland. Stop looking at this nonsense. Stop listening to these idiots, Butcher said. We will be going after them for incitement, and that's what they've been doing. Everybody, please think about what happened last night and the terror you've caused to innocent families. While he declined to identify anyone specifically, he said that the police would be working to understand who is orchestrating this online and in person. The police and residents of Belfast acknowledged that some protesters had gathered peacefully while the violence was carried out by young people, many of them masked, who specifically targeted immigrants, according to the police and witnesses in online video footage. And we also have, moving right along, an article on coastal floods increasing due to human influence, study says. Research points to climate change and rising sea levels by Alexa St. John of the Associated Press. Human-driven sea levels rise has increased how often extreme coastal flooding concerns occurs around the world, according to a study released Wednesday. Experts say that findings are crucial for coastal infrastructure and flood planning as the planet warms. Extreme flooding events are caused by a combination of storm surges, high tides, and unusual sea level rises along the natural climate patterns and human influence. Hurricane Ian in 2022, which caused significant flooding, is an example of hurricanes that scientists said was strengthened by climate change. Coastal flooding threatens hundreds of millions of people living in low-lying coastal areas across the globe each year, cause millions of dollars in damage, and can be deadly. Extreme sea level events that were once historically rare, with those of the 1% chance of that happening in a given year, are now on an average about 12 times more likely. According to a new study in the National Journal of Nature Climate Change on Wednesday. Those events have become about four times more likely to due to human-driven climate change. Researchers examined the frequency of extreme sea level events, which are the drivers of the coastal flooding, and considered long-term records from tide gauges at more than 100 sites along climate modeling. The study looked at the increases from 1900 to 2005. It was limited through 2005 due to the availability of models that attributed instances to human-driven climate change. The office acknowledged the results were conservative, given the human contributions to change in coastal extremes have only increased since then. The experts separated the influences of human activity, natural forces, and local land movement. While sea levels changed early in the 20th century could largely be attributed to natural forces since the 1960s, it is human-caused warming that's the primary factor behind rising sea levels. A separate study published in the journal Science Advances on Wednesday also supports the notion that human-caused climate change is responsible for extreme water levels. It found that climate change at the root of 58% of the days with extreme water levels during the period from 2000 to 2018. The climate change has also, on average, nearly tripled the number of days exceeding extreme water level thresholds since the 1970s. Essentially, every coastal flood today has a human fingerprint on it through climate change, said Ben Strauss, chief scientist at Climate Central, a co-author of Science Advanced Study. Without the extra bit of sea level rise caused by global heating, most of these events would not have reached the status of flood. The research in Nature Climate Change didn't fully examine individual human factors, said Sokhi Dangdorf, the lead author. He noted that greenhouse gases, the result of burning fossil fuels such as oil, gas, and coal, are the most significant. In particular, since the 1970s, it is by far the dominating factor of this course of good news at this moment, said Dangdorf, also an associate professor at Tulane University. The risk is evolving, and with evolving risk, we need to do more for adaptation. Jeff Williams, a retired United States Geological Survey oceanographer who was not part of the study, said that the research shows that the planners need to take into account increased risks. They should also consider what it will cost to increase coastal protection and determine who pays for it. The current protection for New Orleans, for instance, will likely not be adequate beyond the next couple of decades. Nations across the globe are increasingly using renewable energies like solar and wind. Last year, clean power generation exceeded overall global electricity demand growth. And the share of renewables hit more than one-third of the world's electricity mix for the first time. Even in the United States, where President Trump's administration has boosted fossil fuels, solar is growing as coal power declines. As such, scientists have recently said that the world is no longer on track for the worst-case scenario in warming. It is best also not on track to the best case either. Dangdorf, the Tulane author, said the impacts even are relatively little. Sea level rise can be pretty impactful on our coasts. There is a silver lining because we have control about how much we emit, right? He said, so we can stop the development at least to some degree. So we have another article here in the main section of the paper. President Trump threatens more strikes on Iran as countries exchange attacks. Ceasefire tested as Hegseth warns of hard response, by John Gambrell and Michelle L. Price of the Associated Press. Dubai, United Arab Emirates. The United States launched airstrikes Wednesday against Iran, and President Trump said more were coming as Tehran fired back as countries in the region The escalating attacks threatened to derail efforts to end the war, with President Trump warning that Tehran would pay the price for stalled negotiations. President Trump's warning at the White House and on social media came hours after Bahrain, Kuwait, and Jordan, all of which host U.S. troops, came under Iranian fire. It was the second time this week that back-and-forth strikes had tested a two-month ceasefire. On Monday, Iran and Israel targeted each other. "We're going to hit them hard again today," President Trump told reporters at the White House, hours after the United States said it struck Iranian military sites. "We urge Iran to sign a deal to end the war." Shortly after President Trump spoke, the U.S. military said it had fired on an oil tanker attempting to transport oil from Iran in violation of its blockade on Iranian ports. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said late Wednesday that the U.S. military will strike Iran hard overnight. President Trump's comments underline his whipsaw approach to the war. Early this week, he suggested that a deal to end the conflict could be reached in a matter of days. Iran has proved resilient despite weeks of heavy bombing. It is betting that the ability to effectively close the Strait of Hormuz, a critical passageway for oil and natural gas, gives it a strong bargaining chip. Iran's United Nations envoy said that the United States should refrain from threats of force if it wants a deal. Iran has never negotiated under threats and pressure and will never submit to pressure or question, Ambassador Amir Saeed Iramani told the United Nations Security Council on Wednesday. Still, both countries seem to be looking for a way to end the conflict if they can manage to sell it as a win at home. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears intent on pursuing goals that make compromise harder. The collapse of Iran's theocratic government and elimination of its nuclear program and the destruction of the Iranian-allied Hezbollah militant group in Lebanon. Since the United States and Israel started the war with February 28 attacks on Iran, the conflict has shaken up the global economy, driven up energy prices worldwide, and made food and other basics more expensive. The international benchmark for crude oil traded above $93 a barrel on Wednesday and up more than 25% since the start of the war. President Trump said Wednesday that the U.S. military had since last month undertaken a secret mission to sneak oil supplements past Iran's forces in the Strait of Hormuz. He said ships were slipping through at night, aided by the destruction of Iranian radar equipment. President Trump said as a result, more than 100 million barrels of oil have evaded Iran's chokehold on the strait. There was no immediate confirmation of that figure, which roughly equals 5 days of oil shipments through the waterways before the war began. The military's role was not immediately clear. Captain Tim Hawkins, a Central Command spokesperson for the United States forces, communicated and coordinated with commercial ships in the area, but gave no details on military support being offered. The United States military said Wednesday an American aircraft fired precision munitions into the engine room of the Palug flag vessel MT Settlebello in an attempt to breach the naval blockade with a shipment of Iranian oil. India's foreign ministry said that 3 Iranian sailors were missing after the vessel was struck, while 21 others were rescued. Maybe this will end it. The U.S. military said strikes earlier Wednesday targeted air defense, ground control stations, and surveillance radar sites. Iran said U.S. strikes hits 2 water reservoirs in southern city of Shriek, temporarily cutting off water to thousands of people. The U.S. Central Command had no immediate comment. Tehran later claimed attacks in Kuwait, Bahrain, and Jordan. Jordan said it shot down 5 incoming missiles, which Iran said targeted an airbase hosting American military aircraft. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbasar Araghchi condemned the American attacks as a violation of Iranian sovereignty. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Bahaghi said in a televised comment that, the following the new attacks, Iran would review its instance on negotiation to end the war. Efforts to mediate a deal continued. Following consultation with the United States, a delegation from Qatar arrived in Tehran for talks on Wednesday, according to an official with knowledge of the visit, who requested not to be identified. The exchange of fire came a day after the United States Army attack helicopter crashed into the Strait of Hormuz. The helicopter collided with an Iranian drone, according to U.S. officials speaking on as well not being identified. It was not clear whether the collision was intentional. Wary of high gas prices in the run-up to congressional elections in November, President Trump seems to be looking for a quick win. But he is also making demands that will be tough for Iran to swallow. The United States wants to see Iran give up its stockpile of highly enriched uranium. While Iran insists that the nuclear program is peaceful and that uranium is a short technical step from weapons-grade levels, Iran is refusing to give up the uranium and demanding relief from sanctions. And it also wants the release of frozen assets even before the final agreement is in place, something President Trump rejected. It is not clear how these differences can be bridged. In truth, the Social Post Wednesday, President Trump said that Iran was taking too long to negotiate a deal, and now they will have to pay the price. And move on to Metro News. Aide arrested after city council protest. Following delay, officials seek $11.8 million in changes to the budget by Chris Van Berserk of the Globe staff. The Boston City Council meeting on Mayor Michelle Wu's $4.9 billion budget plan devolved into chaos Wednesday when a group of protesters stormed the council chamber and shut down the proceedings for roughly 2 hours. The month-long budget process at City Hall had already been marked by fraught debate over how to respond to Mayor Wu's decision to cut funding for several city grant programs, ranging from support for immigrants to resources for food access. A Boston police spokesperson said officers arrested 8 people who lay on the chamber floor in apparent protest of proposed cuts to youth jobs. After the delay, the councilors returned to the debate a series of proposed amendments to Mayor Wu's budget plans, ultimately voting 12-1 to approve $11.8 million worth of changes. The amendment budget now goes to the mayor, who can veto some or all or none of the council's amendments. A two-thirds majority of the councils would be required to override the mayor's veto. Just as councilors started the debate over an amendment package from the city councilor Ben Weber, roughly a dozen protesters interrupted the meeting, yelling, "You failed us." A pair of protesters held a sign reading, "Save our youth jobs, city funds now, not empty promises of mythical private jobs and funding." Mayor Wu's budget proposal slashed funding for youth job programs, but the mayor later struck a deal with a private sector group to provide hundreds of school year jobs for city teens. Boston police cleared the members of the public from the room as protesters occupied the center of the council chamber. And a contingent left midway through the roughly two-hour standoff, but a smaller group remained. Council Julia Maget, the lone vote against the $11.8 million amendment package, chanted with the protesters and live-streamed the incident on social media. At another point, Councillor Brian Worrell sat on the floor of the council chamber to talk with one of the protesters. Once the police cleared the council chamber, a debate resumed on the amendment to Mayor Wu's budget just before 5 p.m. There will be no more warnings. If you make a disturbance or distraction, you will be escorted out, City Council President Liz Braden said. City Councilor Menard Culpepper alluded to a backroom deal making the protest as the City Council was debating an amendment from Councilor John Fitzgerald. Culpepper said councilors have been working all week long on amendments and things felt pretty good until those young folks came in and took over. Something happened when they took over. Everybody left and it was like smoke, Culpepper said from the chamber floor. They came back in and then we ended up with this. And I feel like I'm being told, take this or you don't get anything. Because this is not the package that I went to sleep with last night, excited about. But something happened when everyone went out and we came back. Councillor Fitzgerald said that the budget process is designed to be chaotic. I know at times it can seem that, but what I hope folks understand is that folks on this body care about the city and we do actually care about one another. At the outset of the meeting, several city councilors acknowledged what had already been a divisive budget process before the protest at City Hall. Weber, who chairs the council's Ways and Means Committee, said this year's budget process was exceptionally challenging, with the costs rising much faster than the revenues, and the tax property rates inching up at the slowest rate since 1998. As a result of those pressures, the mayor's proposed budget cuts many of the grants and programs that support our most vulnerable communities, he said. In the city that must do everything it can to address gaps in wealth, health, and academic achievement that fall along the racial and socioeconomic lines, we need budgets that provide real, tangible support. Mayor Wu's administration has long argued that the city, like others across the state, is facing significant financial pressure, including rising health insurance costs and snow removal overruns, and after two major storms this winter. In response, some councilors have suggested that Mayor Wu should raise the revenue projections to increase the city's budget bottom line or pull from Boston's Rainy Day Fund, an emergency fund, to pay for the programs that are on the chopping block. Mayor Wu has called both ideas fiscally irresponsible. We also have the two. Yep. We have two articles here. One is on the Freedom Trail at 75. The city celebrates those red bricks that offer a step-by-step peek into history by Ariel Lopez, the Globe correspondent. Boston's famed Freedom Trail, the red brick path that connects 16 historic sites from the Boston Common to Bunker Hill, is celebrating its 75th anniversary today, Thursday. About 4 million people each year visit the trail, which leads pedestrians to some of the city's best-known landmarks, including Faneuil Hall, the site of the Boston Massacre, the State House, and other designated destinations, said Suzanne Segura Taylor, an executive director of the Freedom Trail Foundation. They were out there celebrating our freedoms and our history every year, Taylor said on a phone interview. We're just so happy that we have the 75th milestone to say that the Freedom Trail wasn't in existence for that long. Boston Mayor John B. Hines dedicated the trail on June 11, 1951. That year, the city planted signs at 30 street corners pointing pedestrians towards notable locations. In 1958, the red line was painted to chart the path between the sites, and in 1990s, 16 bronze medallions were installed in the pavement to mark each historical site. The medallions are now connected along the most of the trail by a line of embedded red bricks. In recent years, Taylor said that the foundation and the city have worked to make the trail and the sites it connects more accessible. Work is now underway to install a ramp in the plaza behind the Old North Church, where Paul Revere set out on his famed 1775 midnight ride to warn the colonial revolutionaries of British's army movements. The foundation has also begun offering seasonal specialty tours along the trail, a tour highlighting black patriots during Black History Month in February, another spotlighting revolutionary women, commemorated Women's Historical Month in March. This month, the visitors in June can sign up for tours about the Rainbow Revolutionaries that are centered on LGBTQ plus history. Additionally, some of the specialty tours are being offered on Saturdays this summer. We realize that February is Black History Month and March is Women's History Month, but they are not the best times of year to be outside all of the time. Mayor Michelle Wu will write a proclamation to the foundation to commemorate the trail's anniversary. Otherwise, the milestone would be honored quietly. With all the World Cup and everything happening, we are celebrating internally. Sharon McAllister, who traveled to Boston from Dublin with her family for Saturday's World Cup match between Haiti and Scotland in Foxborough, walked the trail Wednesday morning. "I wish every city in the world had something like this," she said. "It was so easy for tourists." Chris Jolly, who visiting from Boston from Utah with her husband, opted to check out different parts of the trail over the course of the next few days instead of hiking its full length in one go. To mark the 250th anniversary of America's founding this summer, Taylor said she had instructed guides to provide more information in Freedom Trail tours about the Declaration of Independence, which was signed in 1776. I've walked some parts of that trail myself, so pretty good, and up to the Bunker Hill Monument. It's a good walk, a long walk. Boston prepares for tall ships, World Cup, and America 250 by Faye Theodoro, a Globe correspondent as well. Boston is preparing for a mega summer of millions of visitors and who are expected to flock the hubs for the World Cup, Sail Boston, and America's 250th anniversary celebration. The festivities will include soccer watch parties, tall ship parades, block parties, and historical happenings designated to ensure residents share in the summertime revelry. "This has been years in the making," said Mayor Michelle Wu Wednesday at a press conference with local leaders at Lopresti Park. "Once the world record-breaking soccer ball drops in East Boston, we will be off and running, and visitors from around the globe will join residents from every neighborhood to celebrate, share culture, and create memories to last a lifetime." The anticipation builds for the events the city is offering Boston 250 and the World Cup theme celebration kits with double Dutch jump ropes, temporary tattoos designed by the mayor's youth council, and commemorative trading cards. The kits are part of a $50,000 grant program aimed to help roughly 100 residents organize block parties and community gatherings, according to the Boston Chief of Community Engagements, Brianna Miller. At Wednesday's press conference, officials promoted fan festivities at City Hall Plaza, which will serve as a central gathering place during the soccer tournament. The free events will feature live broadcasts of matches, entertainment, and cultural programming throughout the World Cup. Registration for fan festivals on Friday and Saturday have already reached capacity, said Mayor Wu, who urged people to reserve spots for the remaining 14 festival days. Mayor Wu also announced $200,000 in grants from Airbnb to help small businesses take advantage of the flood of visitors. The money, which will be administered by the Boston Foundation, can be used for pop-up activations, business corridor preparedness efforts, and neighborhood-based watch parties, and more. Aldo Calais, owner of La Hacienda, a Mexican and Salvadorian restaurant in East Boston, said he is most looking forward to a new law signed Monday that will allow bars to serve alcohol until 3 a.m. "I am truly excited about the spotlight that the World Cup and all the events it will bring to East Boston," who said Calais, who spoke at the press conference as a representative of small businesses. World Cup supporters will not be Boston-only international guests. Beginning July 11th, Sail Boston will bring tall ships from more than 20 countries to the city's waterfront for a five-day celebration. The extravaganza will open with a parade of sail led by the U.S. Constitution and accompanied by military flyovers and the fireboat displays. Ships will dock in Charlestown, East Boston, and the seaport and along the piers throughout the city, offering public access, waterfront programming, and multiple nights of fireworks. The city also unveiled initiatives tied to America's 250th anniversary. The efforts will include 25 new historical markers across Boston. Sounds like it will be a fun time. Continuing on with the World Cup theme, strong in our paper today. Local hoteliers were expecting higher demand, and it hasn't materialized, but things could change. This is by Redmond Bernhold, a Globe correspondent as well. Boston hotels expected a World Cup bonanza months prior to many set high nightly rates and enforced four-night stays to capture the anticipated demand. But days before the first match, local hoteliers are reporting tepid occupancy as they vie for more guests. Prices have dropped, minimum nightly stays have gone from 4 to 2, and establishments are hawking luxe amenities, including help from getting to the city to the games in Foxborough. The city has boasted up to 2 million travelers will visit Greater Boston to see the world's most watched sporting event. Organizers have not said how many tickets were sold, but the results so far portend disappointment for the hospitality industry. There were initial expectations that strong performance would happen, said Bill Brodsky, managing director of the Boston Harbor Hotel, that got a heightened sense of emotion. We'll move on here. The anticipated demand has not materialized for a host of reasons. Tourists have moved vacations from Boston to cities where they can spend less. Geopolitical tensions have dampened booking demands, and short-term rentals have siphoned off a significant number of visitors. While many in the hospitality industry say they hope to see late bookings for the World Cup continue to come in, they also acknowledged that the advance reservations have been weak, particularly for days between the matches scheduled at Gillette Stadium from June 13th through July 9th. As of late last week, Boston Harbor Hotel expects to finish June with 80 to 85% occupancy, which is a few points greater than the years prior. But Brodsky said that some others are far behind expectations. In June, Boston hotel occupancy is anticipated to be at 52%, a 1% rise. The booking window is unbelievably short, said Sean Howe, general manager of the Revere Hotel, Boston Common, in the theater district. For the summer, hotels in Boston, Los Angeles, Dallas, Philadelphia, and Seattle blocked off reservations for FIFA workers, technical staff, media teams, and referees, but early this spring, up to 70% of those rooms were canceled, according to the American Hotel and Lodging Association. 14 of Boston's largest hotels were affected, said Sebastian Colella, managing principal of Advisory Group of Hospitality Consulting. So I'd like to read as well a little bit from the sports page. Also a little on the World Cup. And this is by Dan Shaughnessy. It says, a doubtful Boston will enjoy hosting. It's doubtful Boston will enjoy hosting. The World Cup is here, and it's all the rage in Greater Boston. You cannot gas up your car, pick up an iced coffee at Dunk's, or take a walk through your neighborhood without engaging in a conversation about Haiti versus Scotland Saturday night in Foxborough. Every grade schooler from Eastport to Block Island known that the French superstar Kylian Mbappe had a chance to break the World Cup all-time scoring mark before the month is out. World Cup fever is a local epidemic. Actually, none of this is true. Here in Route 1, here in the Route 1 corridor between Boston and Foxborough, the vaunted Cup has largely been a source of irritation and inconvenience. Tickets prices are astronomical. Transportation promises to be confusing. Local municipalities worry about congestion, security, and advocates have warned of international fans about heightened immigration scrutiny. Sounds like a party, no? That's a lot of celebration when FIFA soccer is ever suspicious and all-powerful worldwide governing body named Boston as one of its 11 American host cities in June 2022. But our four-year run has been a study in chaos, confusion, and fiscal uncertainty. Big surprise, right? I mean, this is Dan Shaughnessy speaking. I mean, did we really expect smooth sailing and universal agreement in a process that involves FIFA, the MBTA, the FBI, the governor of Massachusetts, the mayor of Boston, the mighty Foxborough Select Board, Meet Boston, Robert Kraft's estimable empire, and the mega sponsors such as Coca-Cola and State Street. Local headlines have been harsh as the event nears. It's not all about transportation, parking, and street closures. Citing a baffling conga line of communication breakdowns and bottlenecks. The FBI last week warned events like the World Cup can create conditions that attract human traffickers to exploit vulnerable people. In preparation for the influx of international travelers, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health has activated its emergency plans. Remember how Americans felt in the 1980s when Mike Ruzioni and his friends beat the USSR and then won the Olympic gold medal in Lake Placid? That's what these games meant to fans of the teams playing in the World Cup. Maybe we could suspend cynicism, allow some grace, and stop worrying about the traffic, the parking, and the closure of Summer Street just for a few days. Doubt it, we are Boston. It's what we do. So let the games begin, and a month from now, when Boston Stadium signage is taken down and Gillette's goalposts are reinstalled, we'll know if the whole thing was worth it. I hope you enjoy the games and enjoy your day today, and thank you for listening to The Globe.